2 weeks, two changes at the top, with both results following a nice, easy formula. Manchester team goes to North London, Manchester team loses by 3 goals in North London. Elsewhere, Jose Mourinho is left defending his job after Chelsea's brutal showing against Southampton, and the Merseyside derby provided no reprieve for this year's first managerial sacking, Brendan Rodgers. Welcome everybody to this edition of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll talk about Liverpool's managerial situation after the first break, but first let's talk about the action on the field. Went into the weekend with the red side of Manchester enjoying its perch at the top of the Premier League. Now, thanks to Arsenal's 3-0 win Sunday over Manchester United, City is back on top of the Premier League. To talk about that, I'm joined, as always, by Lawrence McKenna and Kartik Krishnayar. And Lawrence, after a terrible midweek performance against Olympiacos, Arsenal not only knocked off the league leaders, but they're only 2 points back at the top, albeit after only 8 games. So tell us what you took away from Arsenal's convincing performance on Sunday.
Yeah, stop looking at points. Second of all, what I would say is, with Arsenal, it totally depends on how the opposition manager very often approaches them. It can, you know, it can really change a game for those guys. And Olympiacos approached it just right. A lot of Manchester United fans critical post-game about the way that Louis van Gaal approached the match. And I guess that makes perfect sense here because, you know, Arsene Wenger has been exploited tactically in other games, but not in this one. And then when they tried to change it up, by that point, I think the players just lacked the belief and imagination to be able to get behind from a 3-0 down, really.
Mm. Kartik, what do you think? I think one point of view is that Manchester United had a poor 20 minutes. I don't think there's any disputing that. Arsenal jumped on them early, rode that early lead throughout. Another point of view is that, yeah, Louis van Gaal got it wrong, and Arsene Wenger was the beneficiary of it.
Yeah, I think that that's certainly right, that Van Gaal was a little bit naive in his tactics. But look, we've seen Arsenal do this before, and they flatter to deceive, right? We see these sorts of games against teams other than Chelsea. Right, I still go back to the fact that Arsenal is the one team that hasn't scored 2 goals this season against Chelsea. They didn't create chances when they were 11v11. I know everyone's saying, oh, well, they finished on 9 men. And then you see the first 20 minutes today, and you think, where was that? Why wasn't there that kind of impetus when they played Chelsea, when they play in Champions League? It's a very confusing thing. And yes, on their day, Arsenal are the best team in this division. You look player for player, look at the combination of players, they're better than Manchester City. They're better than Manchester United. They're probably better. They're better than Chelsea also, obviously.
Yeah, Kartik, I think that you're a little bit skeptical of your own team because I don't think that any team in this division has hit the heights that City did coming out of the gates this season.
Well, that's true, but I think Arsenal have more quality depth once they get some guys back from injury. Now, of course, injuries are always issues with Arsenal, and City's injury record has already kind of taken the front foot, if you will, with weighing them. But again, I mean, I think City are probably more reliable in big games than Arsenal are, in spite of today's result. That having been said, I think the combination play, Ozil, Ramsey, and Sanchez was really good today when they needed it to be the first 20-25 minutes of the game.
Interesting. With Arsenal, Lawrence, it always becomes this discussion of how do you fit a good result, and this was undeniably a very good result, into context with the larger picture, the larger narrative surrounding not only Arsenal but Arsene Wenger. Even last week on the show, we were talking about how the win at Leicester City was so characteristic of Arsenal because, of course, they're going to push around a team that has a good record but really isn't one of the stronger sides in the division. And one thing that struck me about this result in preparing for that is we can't really say that. We either have to say that Manchester United was a fraudulent leader at the top of the table. Again, don't look at the table so early. I don't want to give you an opportunity to say that again. Or we have to concede that the narrative around Arsenal isn't as ironclad as we made it seem last week.
I guess so early on as well, it's probably silly for every season. Don't we find ourselves sort of getting sucked into this? Well, we'll make a blanket statement about someone and we want it to be able to fit it within this.
Yeah, but we're saying these things about Arsenal not based on 7 or 8 matches. We're basing it on a couple decades of our watching
Wenger. Well, it's been a decade now since the Invincibles. I mean, the Invincibles were, you know, a great side.
Of course.
Before that, we remember other different kinds of Arsenal. So we know how quickly things can change, but a lot of people are already sort of talking it.
But I remember an Arsenal team that got an early season result at Old Trafford 1 year and then finished fourth, and United ran away with the title. I remember an Arsenal team just 2 seasons ago that pushed Liverpool around the same point in the season and were top of the table until Christmas. And guess what? Liverpool was in the title race and Arsenal wasn't. So I we've seen these sorts of games before. This isn't the first time.
Mm-hmm. So, but Lawrence, it sounds like you might be a little bit more open to being convinced about Arsenal than maybe Karthik Nagy.
There are huge elements that I'm convinced by, but then you see the Olympiacos game and you think, right. Well, I guess the thing is I guess that this can't be the zenith of what Arsene Wenger is trying to implement at the club. But I'd also say, seems like it's on the road towards that, and definitely, you know, towards that. Mm-hmm. So if it's never going to be, the problem is we want it to be complete or nothing.
Yeah. Well, I think that's...
And we sort of go, you know, well, if, you know, if it's not complete, then it's not effective at all. And it is effective to some extent. I mean, you know, they score goals against Olympiacos and all those kind of things. So it's just that there are holes in the construction. And as things go, you know, we're going to see that sort of evolve. The problem is whether that will mean they can get a title, because basically it ill-equips them to go a season long. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful for a few games, but it doesn't equip them very well to be able to, you know, do well.
You know, you use the metaphor on the road, implying that there's a progression here or a destination. And I think that's really the tension that you also alluded to. You have results like this. You have results like what happened at Leicester last weekend. And then you have Zagreb, you have Chelsea, you have Olympiacos. Karthik, these results are just all over the map, not only in terms of the actual effect they have on the standings or their potential in Champions League, but in terms of their actual performance. So there's the danger of us sitting here going, oh, 3-0 against Manchester United, this is so telling. But with this Arsenal team, it very well could be they come back after the break and they lose again in Champions League and they lose again in the league. It just seems like they're all over the place.
Yeah, it started with them losing the opening night at home at the Emirates to West Ham. Then they beat a very good Palace team at Selhurst. It started the very first 2 weeks. And then they're the only team, as I said, that have not put Chelsea really under pressure this season when they were 11-11. Yet they got the great result against Leicester, the good result against Palace that I mentioned. They beat Spurs at White Hart Lane in the League Cup, with Spurs playing more regulars than they were playing, than Arsenal was playing. And obviously now this result. So the point I think is that Lawrence is implying that we're on, it's not, we're looking at results when, and we're not looking at like a glass half full or half empty scenario. It's all or nothing. But other teams have projects, right? And there's a progression you can view. Arsenal has had the same project now for year after year after year, and they're always finishing third or fourth in the league. Even with games like this, they had one or two of these types of matches against another top team every season where they look really good, they look rampant, they look in the mood, they look unstoppable. And so it's based on history and experience with this set of players, because remember, this team has had more continuity than just about any other top team in Europe in the players they've had for a while now. It's just something that great performance today, but I'm not going to jump up and down and say, okay, they've arrived. They're going to win the title now. You just can't.
So, guys, let's approach this from a different point of view, because we have this podcast where we're trying to come here once a week and provide some context, analysis, opinion on the results that happen. But as we just discussed, Arsenal makes it so every week when we come here and say something about them, it's very likely to be disproved the next week, more so than other teams.
Yeah.
So, Lawrence, I think you're probably the best person to answer this. Where does that leave us? Because it seems like it's impossible to have an intelligent conversation about any single Arsenal.
Okay. About any single Arsenal. Intelligent conversation.
Well, I guess it's possible to have an intelligent one, just not a very long one.
Yeah, although what you would say is let's unpack some of what we see at Arsenal. We see, you know, a poor structure in the midfield, maybe a lack of personnel to be able to implement that there. Mm-hmm. But you do then think, well, Arsene Wenger has faith in those people to be able to do that. In the back line, you would say that they still lack a player there. In the front line, you'd say they probably still lack a player there as well. And I guess there's just... I mean, today we saw them vindicated for Ivan Petr Cech, because there are a lot of great things that happened for him in the game. But I guess that's the problem, is at the beginning of the season, we're looking for definitives, and I think it's still very much a work in progress, or it's such a malleable thing.
But like Karthik said, like Karthik said, we're not just evaluating this team on eight games.
But it's changed. It's not the same. I mean, we're not looking at, I think, you know, a few people have made this point now. We're not looking at the same Arsenal we were looking at a few years ago, the rough and tumble guys who also happened, the people who play beautiful football who also, in inverted commas, happened to be one of the roughest teams in the league. Hmm. You know, I have someone yelling next door to me because of the rugby, a sport that no one in the world gives a crap about. But the point would be that basically with this, we've got an evolving or a side that, you know, Arsene Wenger wants to work on and wants to take forward. And I think, you know, you do see that progress. And I see it season on season, but I still don't think it's a title winning side.
Yeah. Karthik, I just don't disagree. I don't see progress with Arsenal. I see a team that's very likely going to finish in the top four, very likely not going to really compete for a title in England. And if you want to talk about a progression, it seems like they're progressing in the wrong direction in Europe.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, I, of course, wrote an article earlier this week at World Soccer Talk saying maybe the best thing after the Olympiacos game is to get out of Champions League, finish fourth in the group, not be in Europa League, and then maybe then they can push for the Premier League title, because every season it seems like the same thing happens. They get to the round of 16, they get frustrated in Europe, they get knocked out of the FA Cup around, well, they've been winning the FA Cup recently, but they get knocked out of the League Cup. They lose the League Cup final or whatever. They lose in the League Cup, deep in the League Cup. And their Premier League season goes downhill. I remind you, two seasons ago, they spent about 180 days top of the table. Chelsea spent like 40 days. Liverpool, who finished second, spent like 20 days. And Man City, who won the league, spent like 5 days. Arsenal was leading that title race the entire season, or much of the season, and they finished fourth. That's what happens every season. So that's the bottom line, is that maybe Lawrence is saying this is different. We have to look at this 8-game sample, or 10 games if you include the two Champions League games. But I don't see it that way, because this is the same players. They've made fewer changes to their squad than any other top side in England, any other side in the top flight in England, any of the 20 teams we talk about here in the Premier League. Fewer changes to their squad the last three seasons than any of these other teams. And yes, the players are getting older or getting more mature, the younger players that he's bet in. But the reality is it's still the same Arsenal until disproven. And again, I hate to keep coming back to this, and we're going to talk about Chelsea a lot later in this show. But the way they performed that first 45 minutes against Chelsea before the whole Costa Gabriel blow-up, and the way everyone else has played against Chelsea this season, even the teams Chelsea's beaten, like West Brom, that tells me something about Arsenal's mentality.
Well, it was a very informative result, potentially, or it could just be another peak in Arsenal's peaks and troughs that we've been talking about. But it was only one of 10 matches this week in the Premier League, a Premier League weekend that started on Saturday at Selhurst Park. Crystal Palace continued their strong start to the season, getting goals from Yannick Bolasie and Johan Kabay in a 2-0 win over West Brom. Aston Villa increasingly looked like relegation fodder after a second-half goal from Marko Antonovic gave Stoke City a 1-0 win at Villa Park. First half goals from Glenn Murray and Odion Ighalo left Bournemouth and Watford drawn 1-1. Five goals from the previously struggling Kun Aguero gave Manchester City a 6-1 win over visiting Newcastle. Leicester bounced back from last week's disappointment with a 2-1 win at Norwich City, while Sunderland played most of the second half down a man, gave up a 2-goal lead to West Ham, and drew 2-2 in what was Dick Advocaat's last game in charge. Chelsea, continuing a disastrous start to their title defense, fell to Southampton at Stamford Bridge 3-1, and on Sunday, Danny Ings. Romelu Lukaku scored first half goals as Liverpool and Everton drew 1-1 at Goodison Park, while Christian Eriksen scored twice as Spurs took a point at Swansea. At the top of the league for the second week in a row, we have a new leader, with Manchester City topping the table with 18 points. Arsenal and Manchester United are next with 16 points each, while Palace and Leicester have 15 points. At the bottom, Newcastle and Sunderland are the league's only winless teams, each with 3 points, while Villa is only 1 point better, with 4 points from safety. When we come back, we're going to shift focus to Stamford Bridge and eventually to Merseyside, but let's take a moment to talk about Rabble.tv. At the top of the league for the second week in a row, we have a new leader, with Manchester City topping the table with 18 points. Arsenal and Manchester United are next with 16 points each, while Palace and Leicester both have 15. At the bottom, Newcastle and Sunderland are the league's only winless teams, each with 3 points, while Villa, only 1 point better, is 4 from safety. When we come back, we'll shift focus to Liverpool and eventually to Stamford Bridge, but let's take a moment to talk about Rabble.tv. You know, we're 8 weeks into this season. The Premier League continues to deliver its entertainment on the field, but after 2 months of listening to the same voices call those games, maybe it's time to change things up. That's why I think you should check out Rabble.tv, because it's a new way to augment that television experience. Rabble.tv is a place to listen to live match commentaries from real fans while games are being played, and it works really simply. All you have to do is mute your television after the game is on, and then head over to Rabble.tv to listen to soccer fans providing their own commentaries. Or, even better, you can create your own broadcast and call one of your team's games just by signing up for free and switching on your microphone. You can listen to the broadcast on your desktop or through your iOS app, and now you can listen through your mobile browser, and you can send out the link to it and get all of your friends involved. Sign up today at Rabble.tv, where it's your team and it can be your call. And on our team, we actually have somebody that uses Rabble.tv multiple times per week, and he has a show associated with World Soccer Talk called Divers and Cheats every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Kartik, how's Divers and Cheats going?
It's going well. We didn't do a show this week because it conflicted with our NWSL final here in the United States, Women's League final, which was starting at 9:30 Eastern Time, so there was no point in doing a show since our audience would all be, including myself, would be watching that game. So, but we'll be back this week at 9 p.m. Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern. I don't foresee any more conflicts like that the rest of, at least the rest of this calendar year. So another show this week, likely on a topic related to the FIFA scandal.
FIFA scandal, that's heating up. Yeah, if I sound a little bit tired this week, it's because the NWSL final was here in Portland, and it was actually a really great event, probably surprisingly good considering it was the first time they went to a neutral venue. The league's only 3 years old. But everybody was in town, and there was a lot of celebrating on Thursday when FC Kansas City won their second straight title, a really great accomplishment for that organization. Gentlemen, let's talk about the big story this weekend, and we'll start with you, Lawrence, because it does affect the club that you follow most closely. Brendan Rodgers, I suppose as expected, was fired. We didn't know exactly when that was going to happen. After today's draw with Everton, the news came out. There had been rumors for a while that he needed to get 7 points in these last three games. He didn't really come close to that. So just in general, your reaction to the news that Brendan Rodgers is no longer manager of Liverpool?
He had a good win ratio, but you'd say that a lot of that was probably affected. People almost use his most successful season as a stick to beat him with, which I find slightly unusual. But at the same time, he made a rob for his own back, and very often it was difficult to defend him, I think. And maybe ultimately it caused his own downfall because people measured him by his own bar that he set, which is actually incredibly high, which I respected because as a young manager, I think he should be setting that kind of bar. But I just think there's sometimes, because obviously from the press side, we sort of say, well, you know, it was his words that hung him. But you think, well, FSG are surely not reading the UK newspapers and saying, oh, well, we'll take our advice from there. Mm-hmm. And so they'll be thinking from a very business-oriented, winning-oriented standpoint, you'd hope, as owners of the club. Although maybe the Red Sox say different. But I would say overall, it was that there was what would be the biggest indictment of this season of him as a manager is just the apathy towards Brendan Rodgers and the side. And it's kind of this, it's not like, oh, I'm excited to see this team. It's like, I'm kind of excited to see this team, I think. and it was never like I can't wait for the game. It was like the game's coming, like, let's see how we play. And I just don't think that's what Liverpool fans wanted. Like they suffered that somewhat under Rafa Benitez. And there was, there were obviously ups and downs, and there was never really a consistent final from them. But it was sort of that what they wanted was someone that at least if they were going on that trip with them now, they felt like it was going somewhere. And in that one season for Liverpool, it felt like it was going somewhere. But now I think it's it almost felt like a sort of a mediocre side to the side, which I think that's what annoyed most Liverpool fans was they kind of sat not particularly feeling like they've made any progress in the off season, even though a lot of those signings would indicate that kind of progress. Now, I guess the biggest thing for him was also the theory of Brendan Rodgers versus the theory of Jurgen Klopp. The two don't compare favorably if you're Brendan because, rock and roll football is incredibly exciting. And Liverpool fans want nothing more than to play exciting football and have everyone else go, yeah, you're my second team. And they'll go, yeah, brilliant. All right, cool. Yeah. All right, see you later. Bye. And that kind of, that's, I think that has quite a big, big influence. It's nothing unusual that maybe the owners were here for it.
Would you have given him more time?
I think I was always open to giving Brendan Rodgers more time because of what he'd done and, the fact that he did talk about a philosophy and instilling that and the fact that Liverpool have begun to create more chances, etc. And that they didn't look terrible in this match. I mean, that's the unusual thing is it doesn't feel like a results-based thing because he was sacked after a draw with your local rivals. And that's what I said before the match was, if he draws or he loses, then it's kind of an unusual one because form, in inverted commas, goes out the window. So what are we basing that on? Do you give him a few more games after that? But I guess the biggest problem would be you almost don't want to sack him on that. Like you want him to leave on the idea that maybe he's taking Liverpool as far as he could and he's maxing out now. And, we kind of saw that at Swansea too. So it's almost nothing to be ashamed of, but it's like, if you run out of ideas, you tend to leave a project. And maybe that's the problem, is we see the club and all the success and stuff, and people just draw the wrong kind of lines. If you've taken it as far as you can, then there's no shame in saying, I've kind of run out of ideas here. Like, maybe it's best that someone else steps in.
Yeah.
The problem being that people think that someone else stepping in means a complete deconstruction and then a complete reconstruction, which maybe it does mean at a lot of clubs. But in modern football, there are still going to be things that Brendan's done, like bring in Sturridge and Coutinho and Ibe, and, you know, even getting the club to this level, getting them into the Champions League, you know, getting the best out of young players like Gomez when they first came to the club, bringing in Mignolet, making the team a fitter team, and things like that, which, you know, I think will probably stand him in good stead when Liverpool fans remember him as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the results are this year not terrible. 12 points, middle of the league, but not that far off the top, or not that far off the European places. But the underlying data isn't as flattering. They have a negative goal difference. Exactly. They're not generating a lot of great opportunities. They're giving up great opportunities in about the same ratio. The underlying data kind of suggests they're a middle of the pack team. And obviously for a team that's invested as much as Liverpool.
He spoke about luck today, though. I mean, after the game, and then spoke, but I mean, really the post-match comments don't really mean anything at this point, but he spoke about luck, and you think, well, you're almost lucky to have this many points at this stage.
Right, and it's always weird when a manager talks about luck, because it's kind of an ignorant way to talk about just variance. And
well, yes, but then at the same time, I think something that we've always said, or I've always said, would be the harder you work, the luckier you are. But the problem would be that it's not just about hard work. It's hard work and it's velocity as opposed to speed. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe at Liverpool, Brendan mistook speed for velocity. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that is not fantastic if you're a manager who's constantly thinking he's going in the right direction.
Kartik, would you have given Brendan Rodgers more time?
No, I think it was unfortunate that they spent so much money this summer with a manager that they weren't committed to. Now that's maybe a FSG issue or a boardroom issue, but it was obvious for weeks he was dead man walking. I think really after that West Ham game, the 3-0 defeat at Anfield, he was done for all intents and purposes. There was a lot of attacking talent bought that's been bought in the last two summers, and the integration of the side hasn't quite come together. I also think that, quite frankly, a lot of people, and I talked about this with someone yesterday, actually, offline, that a lot of people in the media, even though you look at Liverpool's point totals, they put in their head that game against Bournemouth, the second match of the season, was actually 3 points for Bournemouth. And because of the circumstances around Bournemouth's goal being chopped off and then the Benteke goal that was clearly offside counting. So maybe that was the way it was being factored in also in the minds of FSG, that basically, okay, we're on 11 points or whatever, but we really should be on 8. And that would put us near the bottom of the table. I do have to say, though, today was an odd time to do it. He leaves as Liverpool manager 8 matches without losing to his local rival, Everton. Again, it was we can get into the match in a minute, but I was very disappointed by Everton. And actually liked what I saw from Liverpool a little more today than what we've seen to this point this season, either in Europe or in the league. So I was beginning
But if we're going to beat
this...
Arsenal with that stick, maybe we have to beat Liverpool with the same stick.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought today the combination of Ings and Sturridge worked very well together, and I felt like Emre Can really fit his role as an enforcer. So did Lucas before he got pulled off with the potential second yellow coming. I kind of liked what I saw from Liverpool today, and I don't know if it was a performance they gave knowing that the manager was gone. Obviously, there's been a lot of speculation about that. Maybe the players knew. Or if they were genuinely beginning to turn the corner this season with this performance and the win last week against Villa, and now they're going to have to start over. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what to make of it. The timing, I think Rodgers was dead man walking, just to summarize, but the timing is still a little odd for me.
Yeah, but I think people are always going to question the timing. But I mean, some people are saying...
Decision must have been made before today is what I guess I'm saying.
Well, I guess the decision, although you might say the decision was made to act if things went a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of, that's why we say dead man walking, was because there was such an air of inevitability around this, wasn't there? Which you didn't want there to be. But the problem is, especially in a stadium like Anfield, it's not just a place where good feelings are amplified. It's a place where you know, negativity is also amplified.
Right. But he didn't lose to Everton. That was my point. I mean, I could see if he had lost this match, the sacking happened. But they were the better team against the local rivals playing at home, who he's never lost to, who were in ahead of Liverpool in the table, if I'm not mistaken, coming into today.
Yeah, and still are.
Yes, but you would say, I guess that's the problem with Liverpool, is that's not where they're aiming for. And so, obviously that's a relative achievement, but where Liverpool are aiming, the stupid thing here is that, we're talking about the table in the first, and that's not a dig at you, Kartik, I'm just saying, the point would be, we can't really talk about the table until where you have a better position to judge from a small sample size right now. But the point still stands, I guess. It's ridiculous that a different kind of decision wasn't made. I mean, they gave him all this money and then sack him so soon seems a little bit unusual. But I guess what that means is they believe that their investment was not necessarily just from Brendan. It was any manager could do well with that squad. And I guess that's the exciting thing when you think about Klopp paired with that squad.
Yeah, let's talk about that in a second, because I mean, this has come up a lot during the time that the three of us have been back together, the idea of the table reflecting a small sample size, and let's not look at it. There are reasons to look at the table. Teams do try to win games, and they try to be higher in the league than lower. So if they're lower, they're not accomplishing what they set out to do, and we can use that in our analysis. Where it goes wrong looking at the table is when you look at the table with a small sample size and try to infer what a team is going to do in the going forward. It is wrong to look at the table and see Chelsea at the bottom of the league and think that they are a bottom of the league quality team. However, they have performed consistent with that to this point. And to this point, Liverpool is not performing up to the expectations of the boardroom, of the people that have brought in those players, of Brendan Rodgers himself. So I think it is fair to look at the table and say this reflects something. You look at the underlying numbers and say, okay, is it likely this team will improve in the future? And unfortunately, there isn't a lot of data to support that contention. So we're left here wondering who can come in and take over the job. And Lawrence, you mentioned Jurgen Klopp. That's the person that's most prominently linked with the position. We've also heard Carlo Ancelotti's name thrown out there. What do you think about those two?
I was evaluating this. Carlo Ancelotti, I think it would be an unusual decision for Liverpool just because of his style of management. Doesn't mean he's not great. It's nothing to do with Liverpool thinking they're better, etc. It's just basically, he's not laissez-faire, but sort of, I'm not going to be there for training. Do it. And then do well on the pitch. Whereas, there's sort of a different approach from Klopp. And it just seems that there's more synergy between what Klopp brings, not only the football, which he aspires to, but also just, the charisma and to use Brendan Rodgers' phrase, the character of the man. He's a top manager. Although then there's also questions over it. He's outstanding, what he's done for this club. And it's that's the weird thing, I guess, is that, people put the question mark over Klopp's final season at Dortmund, but you would say it really would be interesting to see what happened if you mixed. I mean, just the weird thing that I've done is I've almost drawn out the Liverpool team and drawn out that BVB team and sort of gone, okay, Lewandowski, Benteke, Coutinho, Mkhitaryan, Chan goes there, and you. For that reason, it's sort of quite exciting. It's almost a different era of football because that style of football was found out. But you still think, even just for a short stint, rock and roll football would be incredibly exciting at Liverpool.
Yeah, Kartik, I want to get your thoughts on Klopp also, but I do have some thoughts on Klopp that I think it's a really poor fit for the personnel that Liverpool have right now. When you have a coach that is so committed to the style of pressing that was so successful there, and we see at Bayern and Barcelona, and you match that up to the strengths and the qualities of the main people at Liverpool, you wonder how good workers like Henderson and Milner would perform in a system where the players in the middle of the park are always going to be expected to technically execute in tight spaces. You wonder how somebody like Felipe Coutinho is going to perform in a system where how he reacts the moment the opposition gets the ball is as important as how he reacts the moment that he gets the ball. You wonder how somebody like Christian Benteke is going to be executing that press from the top. But you also see other players, like I think Nathaniel Klein would be a great fit for the system, having that wing opened up and having his qualities as somebody that plays in the middle of the park as important as the qualities at the defensive third. And I think Daniel Sturridge is almost, if he can stay healthy, like a prototypical number nine you would want in that scheme. So I think it's a weird fit. I think it would start a whole rebuild of the squad again. And the question I have is whether Liverpool is actually in a position where that is a good thing to basically say, this year is lost, and if we don't treat it as a lost year, we might make Europe, but we won't make the changes that we need to make. We're going to bring Jurgen Klopp in. This next 6 months are going to be a period of time where we can evaluate the squad, implement his system, and we're going to be ready for next year. Kartik, what are your thoughts on Klopp?
That's, I think you've laid it out. You've essentially said what a lot of what I was going to say. I'm kind of torn here. Is this because the sacking appeared to have been made before this result, which I think is a decent result for Liverpool? If he had lost to Everton, I could see him getting sacked. But that leads me to believe that they have a replacement in mind to put in this two-week period of the international break, which very well could be Jurgen Klopp. But I thought about yesterday when I was talking to somebody about Rodgers getting sacked, about exactly what you laid out, that Klopp's style doesn't fit, particularly the two players you mentioned, Henderson and Milner, that are critical to this Liverpool team. They couldn't play in that kind of high-tempo, high-pressing style. And I think you're in this position where some of the personnel that Klopp would inherit at Liverpool would be more useful than the other personnel that he inherits, and some of the better personnel he inherits would be less useful to him. That's point one. Point two is he's going to want complete control over transfers, which you don't have at Liverpool, and he did have at Dortmund. Point three, I think, is do you just ride out this season with a caretaker of some sort and then see what happens with some other potential manager that you could bring in? Because here's the thing, and maybe this is a good appropriate time for this discussion. I've noticed there are fewer and fewer good number twos at Premier League clubs who could take over a team. I think maybe the last time we saw such a thing happen was Roberto Di Matteo, who had his own management experience in the Premier League at West Brom and had been, of course, a great Chelsea player as AVB's number two, and that made AVB sacking very simple for Chelsea when they wanted to do it. But it's one of these things now where you're seeing number twos who cannot step up to that number one job. So there's now almost a market, guys, for a caretaker manager that can take over the way Rafa Benitez did and saw out that season with Chelsea. And they did okay, right? They won the Europa League, and they did okay in the league under him. There's almost a market for that kind of manager that can calm a club, just glide it through the rest of the season when things aren't doing well, and then you turn the page. Maybe that's where Liverpool goes. And if that's where Liverpool goes and they're looking at long-term replacements this summer, this coming summer, Carlo Ancelotti won't be on the list in that case. And I don't really know where they go at this point. But if they're going to make a long-term appointment now, it might very well be Jurgen Klopp. But if they're going to go, let's ride out the rest of the season and then rethink next summer, then it's probably not going to be Klopp.
I don't think they have the time or inclination to be able to ride out the rest of the season.
Yeah.
I think there's players within that squad that will kind of say, well, you know, Coutinho being one of them, I just can't wait. You know, we need a manager in to show the intention of the club, I guess. I mean, that's part of it.
It is such a long time in modern football to basically throw away a year. So it'll be interesting to see where they go. Do they just stick with a caretaker and do the best they can this year, or do they start the transition that they seem to be implying that they need? Do they start that now?
Is there someone within English football that they could grab? I mean, could they grab an Eddie Howe? He's very attached to Bournemouth. His one foray out to Burnley didn't go well, but that would be a guy, if you're ambitious, you could grab. Or do they need an established continental name? And if they do, there's a very short list of guys. Ancelotti would be at the top of that list, and I don't know that he's necessarily the guy for them.
Well, the world in which Liverpool can't get Eddie Howe is not a world that we've ever seen.
But isn't it? Well, that's a weird one, isn't it? Because it's sort of like saying, well, let's go for Eddie Howe. Wait a minute, didn't we just have a manager like Eddie Howe?
I mean, if you have somebody like Jurgen Klopp, and this is the other thing, Lawrence alluded to this, this is the other part of the Jurgen Klopp equation that I find weird. Jurgen Klopp is a man for two different teams in Germany, had 7-year stints where he dramatically improved their fortunes. Mainz has been a steady team in the Bundesliga after he took over, after his playing days were over. And then Dortmund hadn't been in Europe for 4 years before Klopp arrived. They were in 13th place the year before Klopp arrived. They had relegation issues, and Klopp took them to the final of Champions League. He took them to two straight titles in the Bundesliga, and we're now seeing how difficult it is to win the Bundesliga from this version of Bayern Munich. And to look at Klopp's last year at Dortmund, when, just like we're talking about with Liverpool, the underlying numbers don't reflect a good team, the underlying numbers for Dortmund last year reflected a good team that just had bad results that improved throughout the season. And to indict him based on that, I think, is a really, really short-sighted. And the reason I bring all this up is, when you have a chance to get Jurgen Klopp, you get Jurgen Klopp if you're Liverpool. If you are a team that is not a consistent Champions League team, and somebody like Jurgen Klopp, based on his personal preferences and what he likes in clubs, what he likes, he wants a club that is a project right now, but he also wants one with a loyal following, some passion behind it. It is a perfect fit. And so for Liverpool to talk themselves out of that, which I don't think they're doing, but if they were to talk themselves out of that, it would be very, very foolish in my mind.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing. We don't know what they're talking.
Well, we're talking a lot about Jurgen Klopp. Let's go ahead and take our first foray into Europe in the show, talk about Germany, where one of the biggest games of the weekend took place between the two biggest clubs in Germany. But a dominant performance by what at the moment is the best team in the world saw Bayern rout second place Dortmund 5-1. Two goals from Thomas Müller, another pair from Robert Lewandowski, as well as an insurance tally from Mario Götze gave FCB a 7-point lead at the top of the Bundesliga. And while a lot of people are going to roll their eyes at the result and say a typical Bayern, typical Dortmund, Dortmund was undefeated before that game. Bayern is just that good right now. In Italy, Fiorentina, leaders coming into the weekend, were kicking off against Atalanta at the time of this recording, but Inter, the team that was knocked off of Serie A's perch last weekend, had temporarily reclaimed that spot after a 1-1 draw at Sampdoria. Juve got a 3-1 win over visiting Bologna to climb to 12th, and wins by Lazio and Roma have those two rivals in the top four. But let's go back to Germany for a second. Kartik, we've talked about it every weekend, about the excitement of a potential title-contending Dortmund and what that meant for the Bundesliga. It seems pretty clear at this point, 7 points back, first loss of the season, the gap we saw today between them and Bayern, they're not going to contend for this year's title.
Yeah, I was a little unhappy that Alaba didn't get sent off on that foul on Aubameyang and it about the third or fourth minute, but it was one-way traffic for much of the game, and Dortmund were very open. Maybe you could say they were naive today. That's Tuchel, who's kind of he followed Klopp at Mainz. He followed Klopp. There was a manager in between him and Klopp at Mainz, but then he's now followed Klopp at Dortmund, since we talk so much about Klopp. But that was there was maybe a little bit of naivety to the pressing and to the openness of the Dortmund midfield, but they just got slid open. And I have to tell you, if I'm Republic of Ireland or I'm Scotland, since we have a lot of fans of those two nations, people from those nations who listen to this podcast, and Lawrence and I count ourselves among the Republic of Ireland supporters, I think in some regards, I'd be
scared.
Yes, although
sometimes I do throw my weight behind Northern Ireland from time to time, just especially as they've done so well in this qualifier.
Yeah, I know. I want to see Northern Ireland qualify, and I'm looking forward to them getting the results they need in these final two qualifiers. That was a gutty comeback against Hungary.
But that's where we're conflicted, though, right? Because you want to see Scotland go, but you also want to see the Republic go.
Right. But my point was that Robert Lewandowski is on an absolute tear. He's on an absolute rampage at this point. And those are the two opponents for Poland. Now, the good news is that Republic of Ireland and Scotland are competing with one another. So one of them will make the playoff in third. I guess maybe it's damage limitation when you play Poland. Although I think Scotland really needs to win that game. And Lewandowski in this mood, I don't know. I've lost track.
They have to win both. Like, if they don't win both and then other results go their way, then they're out.
Okay, so they're probably not going to qualify. But Lewandowski at this point, is he the best striker in Europe? Probably. Is he the best player right now with Messi injured? I mean, you look at Cristiano. There are moments in time when we get into this debate. Okay, over long term, it's Messi, Ronaldo. No question about that. But there have been snapshots in time where Ibra has been the best player in the world. There are snapshots in time where Luis Suarez has been the best player in the world. Mm-hmm. Neymar. Are we in that moment right now with Robert Lewandowski?
Maybe. Yeah, I was wondering that today because as we started recording, Karim Benzema had put Real Madrid ahead at Atleti, and Benzema has been their best player this year, and I think we take him for granted because he's not this physical force that his partner Ronaldo is there, but he's really having a moment too right now as Ronaldo. Some of the age is starting to show on Ronaldo, and they see that they can rely on Benzema more with Bale out and Rodriguez out. He's been Mr. Reliable for them. I think it's a really interesting discussion, kind of one that leads naturally into our players of the week. I'm going to go ahead and fall on this sword, and I'm going to take the obvious one. Sergio Aguero had 5 goals against Newcastle.
What a fall. Yeah. What a fall you took, Richard. Thanks for falling on that sword.
So I'm going to go ahead and go with Sergio Aguero and let you guys have the more interesting picks. Kartik.
Sadio Mane. I thought he was fantastic in Southampton's 3-1 win at the Bridge. We saw precisely why why I was going to say Ronald Koeman. Ronald Koeman's adversary, Louis van Gaal. Of course, we know they don't get along. Both former Barca men, Dutchmen. They don't get along, and we saw exactly why van Gaal wanted Mane in this game. He was running the show, running the channels, great with the ball at his feet. He usually played the right pass when they were in the counterattack, weighted his balls perfectly, just really all-around classy performance.
Yeah, and Southampton were so impressive coming out of halftime on Saturday, and a lot of that is Chelsea. Chelsea really got exposed as the slow, methodical team at the back that they sometimes can be, but Southampton was very impressive recovering from William from the dead balls seem to be Chelsea's only attack at this point. Lawrence, your player of the week.
Good question. Honorable mentions, obviously, must go to the likes of Vardy and maybe even Redmond up front for Norwich, because I thought he had a good game despite losing in the end. I'd also like to mention Jan and Via, despite them losing their manager this weekend, obviously. My player of the weekend is going to be... It's going to have to be Sanchez for me. Fantastic, aggressive for me. He sums up everything. He's almost like the Premier League, but in a nutshell. He's small, he's compact, he's aggressive, but in a very graceful way. And, when he first came up, people were like, he'll be the next Luis Suarez. I think he's graceful in a very different way to the way that Suarez was, and impactful, and also the sense that you can't really leave him in the space that he likes to be, but it's very difficult to man mark him. So it's very hard to take Sanchez out of a game. And he's kind of having a moment right now, which I just love.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Another player that, like Lewandowski, is having a moment. Maybe not quite as bright, but certainly one that's of note. Let's shift topics, gentlemen, to the other big story, another managerial story this weekend. Brendan Rodgers, I guess, technically won the sack race because Dick Advocaat resigned from his position at Sunderland today.
What would they pay out on? Which manager to go first or which manager to get sacked? I guess it's how you make the belt, right? But
Yeah. Carter, do you know the answer to that question? Is Advocaat considered the winner of the sack race even though he wasn't sacked?
I think it's Rodgers because he was sacked. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that seems like you'd have to pay out on that, or else the bet becomes less about bad performances and more about managerial predilections. But we're down two managers at this point, two teams that are making the transition. But perhaps the most intriguing coaching position in the league is the one at Stamford Bridge. After Saturday's loss to Southampton, Chelsea manager Jose Mourinho gave just a meandering soliloquy after the game as part of his post-match comments, one that ended in a defense of his job, saying that if Chelsea sacked him, they would be sacking the best manager in the club's history. So, Kartik, Jose Mourinho obviously up for talking about his job. He brought it up. Let's take advantage of the moment. Where do we start with Jose Mourinho, his job, his security at Stamford Bridge?
Well, his job security should be zero right now, and I think he trying to use again the media. The media in England has been his great enabler through the years, trying to use the media to bully Roman Abramovich. Basically, that 7-minute diatribe was: you want to sack me? You really want to sack me? Here's what you're dealing with, and it was a narcissistic rant. The likes of which we have not seen. Well, we've seen him because we've seen him from Jose, right? But you don't see him from other managers. And Jose has done something outrageous every single week this season, since the start of the season, starting with the Eva Canario situation, right on through that rant, goading Arsene Wenger constantly. He is consistently making this about himself, and then his... he dared the FA to suspend him because he was getting after the officials. Although the funny thing is that the clear-cut penalty that was missed in this game was when Mane got taken down in the area, right?
Right.
So Southampton had a clear-cut penalty. The Falcao one, a little more ambiguous. I thought maybe it should have been a penalty, but a lot of people disagreed with me on it. So yeah. I'm open to the discussion of that. But Mourinho is a narcissist. We've said this for years. He has to be the center of attention. His team is performing not just below their level, but they've now lost twice at the Bridge this season. They drew a game to Swansea. The only good result they have at the Bridge was that game against Arsenal, where they were up a man for 45 minutes and up for two men for about 15 minutes. And it is incredible to see the sagging spirit of a club that was always so united and would always rally. And I have to think, and I'm throwing out a theory here now, and I know this is might ruffle some feathers. I have to think how he handled the medical staff and Eva Canero and her assistant, whose name eludes me. I think that may have had an impact on the players, because the players, Chelsea, like every big club, has a lot of big players who get injured, who are playing so many games. Remember, Oscar had to play 70 games a couple seasons ago because they were in all these different competitions. So they spent a lot of time in the physio room. And I think that might have broken the spirit of some of the players. Hazard clearly wanted medical attention when he went down, right? And she ran onto the pitch. JT is the captain of the side. He's been this Mourinho stalwart. In fact, I think so much of his behavior on the pitch, demonstrative behavior on the pitch for the last decade, as Chelsea's captain and as England's captain for part of that period, came directly from Jose Mourinho, was imparted in him by Jose Mourinho. He now suddenly seems to have had a falling out with Jose. I have to think the physio situation was a trigger on all of this. It's just a theory, but we're seeing players essentially quit. Very seasoned professional players who have played for multiple managers, have played like professionals for multiple managers, kind of quit in the midst of games as Mourinho goes rants and calls them all out in press conferences. So I think it's a bad moment. He has to be sacked. I think that's Aldricott stepping down. Is you know, a 50-50 thing for me, flip of a coin. We talked about Rodgers. I'm not sure. I think he was a dead man walking around. I'm not sure this is the right time. Mourinho has to be sacked, in my opinion. He has to go.
The rant at the end of the game just reminded me of something you would have seen, like, in the movie Office Space. Or I started thinking of Edward Norton in Fight Club going into his boss's office and beating himself up so that he could leave his job. I mean, this is the act of somebody who has imagined the final act of his position and isn't waiting around for that act to finally start. He is defending his job as if he's already being told he's going to be fired. And if I'm an owner and I see somebody's mind is already drifting away from the job, maybe that ends up making the decision for me. Lawrence, what do you think? What do you think about the whole Jose Mourinho situation?
Farcicals, sort of. we end up again being distracted from the actual result, but I guess that's almost feels by the by, doesn't it, at this point? I think one thing I would notice is that does open up the top four. Yes. To the likes of someone like Spurs, or maybe even Liverpool, if they feel like they're still within the points, which they are. Although you'd say it would take time to transition with a new manager. They did say, and in fact, there was an interesting article, I think it was by Dan... I'll look it up on The Guardian, but basically it was on The Guardian. It was saying, looks as if players have lost somewhat of the faith in Mourinho, like Kartik was alluding to. But one thing that he did unpack was the idea that, if John Terry can go and, a couple of other people who are close to Mourinho almost have them feel like they're stabbed in the back a little bit by Mourinho, then what's going to happen to me? Like, am I next one for the job? How do I protect myself? Do I put in a solid performance, or do I put in a performance which is, over exaggerating? And at times in the past, Mourinho's had people who respond to that drama very well, but this group of players don't seem to be responding to the drama very well at all. Mm. And, it's a play of the dice, really. Like, it's a final throw of the dice for him. And, the final throw threw up Not such good numbers. They didn't combine, and this bet's not going particularly well.
I think it's becoming clearer game by game that something that we have started talking about in the last few weeks is probably something that needs to be said whenever we're talking about Mourinho. This is a team that he inherited 2 years ago that was on the verge of being broken up. The results were waning. That was the year that they dropped down into Europa League. They had brought in Rafa Benitez at the end of the season, and the core what's going to be a legendary core of players at Chelsea just looked like it had passed. And Mourinho, I guess you can argue, almost did a disservice in a way to Chelsea's long-term plans. It's hard to say it's a disservice when you win a title, but he got a couple more years out of that core with two or three key acquisitions. And now they're at the point where Mourinho is being judged against those accomplishments without really the discussion of the fact that this team probably needs to be broken up and built back up with the youth that they have or with some other purchases. And Kartik, I think when Chelsea is making this decision about whether to let Mourinho go, they really need to ask themselves, who do they want in charge of that rebuild? And if the answer for that is Jose Mourinho, they can look at this as like, you're doing a bad job with this current situation, but we're going to change the situation because eventually we're going to have to do that anyway.
Yeah. I look, they've got some players that are part of that core that have played for an incredible amount of managers. Ramirez is in his sixth season at Chelsea now. He's played for five managers. So this is the sort of thing where I think the players are accustomed to managers coming and going also. Mourinho may think he has a birthright to that job, and he created Chelsea. Obviously, Wenger took a dig at him last week saying, no, it was Ranieri who really built this team, which that was, of course, that set Mourinho off, of course, talking about how Wenger was the king and all of this. Again, another sideshow, which distracted from a poor Chelsea performance against Newcastle. But they have to make a concerted decision now. Do they want to blow this thing up and rebuild and do it in a methodical fashion with a younger manager that has a philosophy? Do they think Jose's the guy to do that? Because Jose's never a long-term solution for a job. He's never been in his career. But is he serious about this being his club and his love, English football and Chelsea, and wanting to go through this again? Then maybe they have to clear the decks in January and this summer and just ride it out this season. Or do they do the same thing as they did with Benitez, caretaker, and then they go looking for someone this summer? The other thing that needs to be brought up here is the way Jose's behaving. And you great analogy with the Edward Norton movie. That was like a desperate nuclear final act of a narcissist who's looking for attention and just the kind of going nuclear reaction. Do other big clubs, because Mourinho doesn't manage non-big clubs. He's not like Ranieri, who'll go manage Leicester City, even though Ranieri had a track record of just going to big clubs before Leicester. He only manages big clubs. Do the likes of Bayern, Real Madrid would never touch him again, but the likes of the Bayern, Barcelona's, Inter's, Juventus's, they see this, Manchester United, Manchester City, they see this sort of behavior. Is there a chance he doesn't get another sniff at a job like that when he leaves Chelsea? Maybe PSG would take him, but that's the only one I can think of that might tolerate this sort of behavior.
People see it as a bit of a kickstart, though, don't they? I mean, you know, they'll look at the Chelsea model and they say, well, you know, Mourinho built that side, he bought a load of great players, he attracted a load of egos along to the club, and then all those managers did well after him. You know, there was a lot of success.
So keep him for 2 years, basically, is the philosophy?
Yeah, basically, keep him for 2 years, begin to build something. You know, people are almost wise to that. So, like we say, it's post-Mourinhoism or whatever it is. And, you know, then you bring in other people and there's this sense of also relief. Oh, thank God all that pressure's gone. Thank God all the drama that we had around the club. There's a couple of players who he's been built up by. And, yeah, I think it works for a lot of clubs as well. I mean, you know, other managers have had success post-Mourinho. You know, Ancelotti won the Champions League not long after he left. And, you know, it wasn't. It, had they not had the terrible turmoil at Inter, then it maybe would have been a different situation.
I think there are two clubs that immediately come to mind when we think about the future for Mourinho. One is because of Mourinho's apparent affinity, borderline obsession with the job, and that's Manchester United. I just don't see that happening. I could see a scenario where, from Mourinho's point of view, he loses his job at Chelsea, spends a year in the media, being an on-camera person. And hopefully he's the person that takes over for Louis van Gaal. And I just don't see Manchester United doing that. The other one, when you look at the big clubs around Europe that Jose hasn't been with and have the statures that he wanted, it would be Juventus and the moment that they're having with Max Allegri now and the success that Jose had when he was with Inter. There's a bit of a personality clash there, but it seems like a fit. And the only other possibility that I really think of is if Jose goes back to Portugal and basically takes a job at one of the big three clubs, whichever the big one finishes lowest in the table, because they invariably change their managers when they do that. So those are the possibilities, I think. But Kartik, I do think that the list is getting very, very narrow, and it would take a special set of circumstances. And the Real Madrid opportunity that he got, which was really just a club that had a strong, strong team and just wanted that little bit of a push, I think he's going to have to go lower and go towards a club that has decidedly taken a step back.
Right, yeah. The Real Madrid situation was one where he was available. They had decided, even though Pellegrini had a really good season, Pellegrini didn't see eye to eye with Florentino Perez, and this was Real Madrid trying to get one over on Barcelona, right? I mean, he's no one irritates Barca as much as and irritates Pep as much as Jose, so they did it. But I look at Chelsea now, where we've talked about Jose's, and I agree with you, the list is very short of where he can go. Look at Chelsea's situation. if Roman has not patched things up with Carlo Ancelotti, he probably should, because I could see Ancelotti coming into this team.
Great hire.
Yeah, I could see Ancelotti coming back into this side, calming things down, and Chelsea finishing in the top four. Still,
I
absolutely can.
Yeah, for a team that's lacking confidence after what Mourinho has done to him, that he'd be just the perfect hire. And you know, they still have a core of talent that could finish in the top four. I think we're seeing a lot of cracks in the talent. Every time we watch Chelsea, guys, it's the same questions that go through people's minds. Why is Branislav Ivanovic even playing? Why is Cesc Fabregas seemingly an obligatory starter? We're talking about times when even in Hazard now is maybe, maybe that's just rotation. You never really know. But obviously, everybody's job has to be questioned, Lawrence. And I think that, for me, is the thing that I wonder what's going on with Mourinho, because there are these players that are performing so incredibly poorly, and they're still getting spots in the starting 11, Ivanovic and Fabregas specifically. And I wonder if that's just Jose Mourinho's pride just being his undoing, and him saying, these are really the best players that I have for these positions. I am going to play these players. I know better than you. And we're not losing because of them, when everybody else is looking and saying, you are losing because of Branislav Ivanovic.
Well, I guess to some extent people believe that. But could you also say, though, I guess it's sort of, when we're evaluating players like this, then it always makes sense to kind of say, well, you know, could you get someone better? Could you do this? Could you do that? There is a chance he's right.
Well, absolutely. But I suppose there is a chance he's right. But Kartik, it seems very unlikely, because we are familiar with some of the replacements that would be there for Cesc Fabregas, whether it's Jonny Mikel, or moving Mira's in there, or even moving Oscar back into a deeper role. And we are familiar with the options that have been brought in recently there. And I think Lawrence is right, and even when I'm saying this, you know, Jose Mourinho does know more about those players than we do. But we also know enough to know that those players are drastically underperforming.
Right. So the Ivanovic thing and Fabregas thing, I want to separate. Ivanovic, I think it's a bit of a necessity. I had a theory that if they got John Stones, he was going to play. He had played right back previously, remember, when Everton bought him from Barnsley. And Martinez made him into a center back. Moyes had him as a right back. That maybe he was going to play right back and see out the season. They didn't get Stones. I think there's not that much confidence in Baba Rahman yet, who they bought from Augsburg. They've got the possibility of playing Aspilicueta at right back and Rahman at left back, but I think it's a tough one. Now, with the Fabregas situation, Fabregas has been one of, and I'm not, this is not hyperbole here, this isn't just a hot take, he's been one of the worst players in the Premier League this season that I've watched. It's hard to believe we're saying that about Cesc Fabregas. He's not just one of the worst players at a big club, he's one of the worst players I've watched this season, consistently. Yes, they could put Ramirez there. They could slide him into that role. And I think Ramirez actually fits that role very well. They could drop Oscar back. That might not be as clean a fit. Maybe you play a double shield, Matic and Mikel. There is also the possibility, and Mourinho has alluded to it, of bloodletting Loftus-Cheek a little more, the youngster. So there are options. To me, it is mind-boggling that Fabregas has continued to be essentially the first name on the team sheet, besides a guy like Hazard and Costa when he's not suspended. I mean, it's stunning, because Fabregas, this might also be about this whole Wenger thing, because Fabregas, obviously, Wenger passed on bringing him back to Arsenal. That is now looking like a smarter and smarter move. And there is, Mourinho is so into this Wenger thing and baiting Wenger that I wonder if that might be a motivation. It's not something we would attribute to another manager and say, oh yeah, a mind game is a motivation for continuing to play an inadequate guy in your first 11 every week. But with Mourinho, who knows? He does bizarre things.
Hmm. Well, can I also say that I think this is partly about, it's not only a Mourinho thing. And I think the biggest problem is that we're making it about Mourinho, and we're not going for the wider context almost. Because everyone's like, well, you know, should he be sacked? There is an incredible amount of decadence in the Premier League. And, you know, Kartik's been flagging this for years. You know, our coefficient's going down. You know, we're spending so much money within the league. Everyone else is investing here. Everyone else is investing there. And I think players aren't, I mean, players to some extent are in a bubble, but they know about other leagues. And there's almost like a players' union. You know, they know when other people win, and they text each other, and they know about the cultures at other clubs. Maybe not as well as you would like to know, or, you know, like in the same way you work at one blog, I don't know anything about the culture at that blog. I know about the culture in England, but players know when things are trendy and, you know, what other projects are like. And I do imagine that there are players who have come from other cultures such as Fabregas, a number of other Chelsea players with a lot of experience. And they come to the money and it becomes so ubiquitous within their lives, and it is currently so ubiquitous within football. They could go to so many clubs, Juventus, Chelsea, Man City, Barcelona, Real Madrid, all these clubs where they could be paid a great wage and they could win things. And you think at that point, and it's almost being demonized now, it almost becomes like, well, okay, well, you spent your money, you've won the league, now what? And, you know, we see a lot of celebrities go for Scientology and those kind of things to try and fill the gap. I think some players lose motivation because they sort of think, well, what is there left to achieve now? Mm-hmm. And then they sort of look back and they think, well, actually, it's to play good football and not be stressed while playing football. And it's to play under a manager that I enjoy. And it's to play as part of a bigger project. And a lot of people sell the Dortmund players in on that. And then City come along and they go, but no, wait a minute, money rules all. So, you know, this is a free market and the money will sort things out. But actually, that's not always the case. Mm. And it's just that we live in this bubble of, well, the money will sort it, or the market will sort it, or it'll all play out. And we think it does. So therefore, we assume all that is given. But I don't think it is. And I think it plays a huge part at Chelsea right now. The players are unhappy. And, you know, there's also a huge amount of money floating around at that club. And it's not necessarily always going to be the best cocktail.
Kartik.
Sorry, that was a rant, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But it does.
It's true.
It does provide some needed perspective, and it probably highlights the dangers of breaking up the leadership structure of that club, because when you have highly motivated players who have proven over the years that they're able to transcend that money issue and that complacency issue, then taking them out of the structure of the team becomes more perilous. Kartik, international break is upon us. When we come back from it, is Jose Mourinho the manager of Chelsea?
I tend to think no, but it may depend entirely on the scenario we laid out, because Ancelotti is the clear guy that could take this job and fix the team right now. But he has already been sacked once, sacked in the tunnel at Goodison Park, remember, by Roman's henchmen when he was sacked at the end of the 10-11 season, when Chelsea failed to win the title that season, even though they pushed United. So if that's not patched up, maybe he will be. I mean, I can't, but it's not going to end well, right? He's going to get sacked at some point this season. He's not going to be the manager next year at this time. There's no way. So I don't know. Maybe they do it now and they just go with another caretaker. Who knows?
Lawrence?
Is the inevitability flown over to Chelsea at this point? Because the thing is, the eye will now shift.
Yeah.
You know, he had enough of that. He had his canaries down the mine, and those canaries now gone. So it looks inevitable, but that's not because of everyone else, is because of the way Mourinho is acting. And I think Kartik's right. You know, that rant today was one of someone who feels like they probably should, who almost thinks, you know what, I deserve to go. Yeah. I'm going to have to pretend that I don't, so they'll all believe it and print it in their papers.
Yeah, he's trying to control the story because he knows where it's going. It's been a weird weekend in the Premier League because we've had these two or three major stories to talk about, and it's taken up most of the show, but we do want to at least touch on the rest of the games from around the Premier League. First, let's go ahead and get caught up on the other leagues that we watch week to week in Europe. In France, as in most leagues that we follow, the big game was kicking off as we started recording. PSG was hosting Marseille. PSG are still undefeated atop the league, and they'll stay there regardless of the result in the Classique. But newly promoted Angers is in second place after their third win in four, a 1-0 win over Bastia, where the winner was scored by a man with one of the best names I've seen in European football. His name is Billy Cateau Pomphone. He's a French-born Laotian international who spent one season at Sion in Switzerland, but has spent most of his career in the second division of France. Cateau Pomphone. I love that. I think there are 16 letters in his last name. It's just good to see new names come up. But
when you say palm phone, do you mean like palm phone?
P-H-O-M.
Okay, right.
Then
okay,
phone.
My mistake. Yeah. I thought it was that P-A-L-M-P-H-O-N.
Yeah, that's just
that's a Samsung deal waiting to happen, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, that's just my California accent coming out. But in a weekend of huge games, probably the biggest game this weekend was in Spain. We've already alluded to it once. By the time we had hit record on the show, Real Madrid was already up 1 goal at the Calderon on Atletico. Karim Benzema had scored in the 9th minute. But there was another result of note in Spain. Lionel Messi injured with Barcelona for a couple months. Barcelona with a very difficult trip to the Sanchez Pizjuan. Andres Iniesta Iniesta. Also hurt, forcing Javier Mascherano into a midfield with Sergio Busquets, something you rarely see at Barcelona. The team played pretty well, but they lost 2-1 in Seville. Really good result for Unai Emery's team.
Is that a double
team.
Pivot they're playing in the midfield?
No, they had actually pushed Busquets up to where he's playing more like a Bastian Schweinsteiger, a shuttling type role, which was
Bastian
really...
now or Bastian back then?
Bastian, a hypothetical. Okay. So you got the rare sight of Busquets actually charging into the penalty area to add another attacker. So it was very interesting, and they pulled it off quite well. It was a very good performance from Sevilla this weekend. Also of note in Spain, Villarreal lost for the first time this season. They were still atop of the league when we went to press today or went to record. They lost 1-0 at Levante after Bojan Jokic was given his second yellow card in the 36th minute. Spain's down to two undefeated teams. Real Madrid, people know that. Celta Vigo, second place as we were going to record. Gentlemen, the other thing that we usually do on every show is give our top fours. I'll go ahead and give mine first. Top four on form, I've got City, 6-1 victory. Then I have Arsenal. I'm going by league form here in their last two league matches. Win at Leicester, very impressive win against Manchester United. Then I have Crystal Palace, and then, for lack of a better option, Manchester United. End of the season, this is the first time I have Chelsea outside of my top four at the end of the season. I have City, United, Arsenal, and Spurs. Really,
Liverpool with Klopp.
Yeah. Well, I really debated whether I actually put Crystal Palace fourth because, as you alluded to earlier in the show, Lawrence, if you drop Chelsea out of that mix, if you're inclined to see them as not finishing in the top four, it becomes really, really open and honestly really exciting because you can also make a case for a team like West Ham based on the results. Lawrence, let's go to you with your fours.
Okay. This for me is just, you know, so I almost leave it down to myself to sort of pick as we're making the show. I let Kartik shape my views. But I'm going to put City top just because, you know, the absolute thrashing of Newcastle, but there was inevitability about that. I'm going to put Arsenal second. I'll put Crystal Palace like you did in there and then Southampton, but we'll taper the Southampton achievement by saying, you know, Chelsea. Yeah. My top four come the end of the season are Manchester City, Manchester United, Arsenal, Liverpool with their new manager.
They're close enough. It can happen. Kartik, your fours.
Okay, this is league form only, remember. So I'm going 1 Spurs, 2 Palace, 3 Arsenal, 4 Manchester City. And then end of the season, we're going to go 1 City, 2 United, 3 Arsenal, 4 Spurs.
I love how it's almost hard for you to put City in there because there seems to be something where you watch this team so much, you have doubts that you can't shake.
Well, but they lost the last two league games. We're talking about league form only.
Yeah.
Two league losses prior to this. So Spurs are now unbeaten in several league games in a row. I want to say Spurs have not lost since the opening day. So they're seven games unbeaten.
Let's quickly talk about the rest of the matches. Kartik, let's go ahead and start with the result at the Etihad. 6-1 victory. The big takeaway from this is so many questions about Sergio Aguero's form, his fitness. Definitely put it to rest this weekend.
Yeah, he certainly did. And I think the other thing that we saw in this game that was real significant for Manchester City was the ability of Jesus Navas, again, to change the game when he comes on. We've seen it many times. City fans, very impatient. They see his end product isn't quite there a lot of times, but he has an ability to take on players, draw corners, draw fouls, change games. He came on at halftime. The match was very open. The first half was a very even first half. Maybe Newcastle had a little bit better of the play. Second half, one-way traffic. A real quick note on Newcastle. Steve McClaren now has an international break to figure it out. I'm seeing signs in these last two games. I know they lost this game 6-1, but then the Chelsea game before that. I'm seeing signs that it might come together. Suspensions, injuries, it really hurt them trying to coalesce this team. I'm not as panicky about Newcastle as I am about Villa or Sunderland at this point.
Yeah, let's wait to see how they look after getting three or four straight games with Mitrovic in the team. Lawrence. Crystal Palace, 2-0 victory at against West Bromwich Albion. It was at Selhurst Park. They're still in the top four. They're still performing very consistently. Same style of game all the time. No flukes here. It's becoming much, much easier to believe in what Alan Pardew is doing as far as a team that can actually challenge for Europe, maybe even take advantage of Chelsea's swoon.
Do you remember that Newcastle team a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I don't remember the coach of that team, though.
I don't think anyone does, especially not Joe Kinnear. Although I believe Joe Kinnear couldn't actually remember half the team. So what I would say about that is, I mean, that's the only tapering factor. Well, not the only one, but one of a few tapering factors here is, you know, if you take maybe one or two of those parts out, like you could say with any side really in the Premier League this season, then things fall apart a little bit. But it was a fantastic performance, especially from the likes of Zaha. Balassi got the goal, but really the emphasis wasn't so much on him. Zaha was incredible down the wing. And Kabai in the centre of the park, another Palace fan texted me post-game and said, he's graceful. He's an Adonis in the centre of the park. The only thing that the thing he said was, I can't believe I'm typing this to you, but I can't wait for Connor Wickham to come back. And I was sort of confused by that, but because if you don't watch a team too often, and you're watching from outside, then you don't necessarily think about these individuals coming in. But what I think with Palace is he's right. You know, if Glenn Murray had have stayed, but the only reason he didn't stay, by the way, was because he got offered a bigger contract, more money somewhere else, which isn't, and the Palace fans have no grudges about that. They understand why he would do that at this point in his career. But what they now think is, what if Wickham was fit or Murray was here? What more would we have? Because, you know, what if Shamak was fit, for instance? So there are even more exciting times. I think a lot of
the team is loaded. I mean, I've gone over this with a couple of friends of mine. You look at Palace's bench, it's as strong as any team outside of the Arsenals, the Manchester Uniteds, and the Manchester Cities. It really is.
Yeah. But these guys are very tactically intelligent fans, and they know what they want their side to have. And I think that, you know, the weird thing is, you know, Arsenal maligning their big man in Giroud, maybe. Whereas Palace fans are calling out for one, which is strange. And you know, very often when lower league fans or fans that lower down the league do that, it sounds strange because generally it means
Shamak is a perfect example of that, because when he went to Palace, he was very effective. Now under multiple managers, he's hurt now, but you saw a completely different utilization of the player and confidence than he had at Arsenal almost instantaneously when he went to South London.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
Kartik, one of the late games on Sunday, Swansea 2-2 draw at home with Spurs. Spurs, like as you mentioned, another good result. Completely different team with Christian Eriksen healthy. However, Swansea continues their swoon from the plateau that we saw at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, first off on Spurs, delicious football today. They should have gotten all 3 points. Some great saves from Fabianski. And I really like what Pochettino is doing. I firmly believe they're going to finish in the top four this season. Whose expense that's at right now looks like Chelsea, but maybe it's at someone else's expense. But let's talk about Swansea. I think Leon Britton was such an influential player and just keeping the ball moving and going side to side. Maybe there isn't as much of an emphasis on that in people's minds in England, the types of things Xavi did. Of course, Xavi's at an exceptional level, right? But that type of player in the midfield. Key has a little bit of that in him, but he doesn't quite have Britton's ability to kind of just keep the ball moving and be very tidy with it and be in the right position. Swansea's lacking that now. They've got in Sigurdsson and Shelby guys that go forward well, but they're not necessarily covering space. They give the ball away a lot. It's a very un-Swansea-like team, and obviously Britton survived through Rodgers and Martinez and Sousa and Laudrup and all these managers, and Monk has phased them out. But they need that kind of player if they're going to play like Swansea. They look out of sorts. They were fortunate to get a draw today at home. I'm very worried about Swansea. I'm about as worried about them as any side outside of the teams we've mentioned, Sunderland and Villa.
Speaking of Sunderland, Lawrence, Sunderland 2-2 draw at home to West Ham. Not a terrible result, but as we heard during the week, Dick Advocaat, it was going to be his last game. He resigned on Sunday. So where does Sunderland go from here?
To Big Sam. They go to a reduced style of football. They probably go for a manager who... to be fair, it's not terrible. I mean, we saw the potential that Sunderland have to play some great football there. So it's not all doom and gloom, if you like. I think, basically where they go from here is they try and put 35 points together, maybe, and see if that's good enough to keep them up.
Yeah, I don't want another season with Sunderland in the Premier League. They need to go down.
Really?
They need to. I'm just tired. No. I'm just tired of this scenario playing out every year.
Yeah, but I think they need to stay up in order for this to work.
I hope they don't get Big Sam, because they get Big Sam, they'll probably stay up.
So,
I agree.
So weird we're talking like this.
Yeah, I agree with Richard. They need to go at this point. I mean, every season we go through this, and their payroll is so bloated. They've been in the top 10 in wage bill. I haven't seen this season's yet, but the last three seasons, these three seasons where they've had these great escapes all in a row under different managers, and then the manager gets sacked early in the following season or leaves, they've been in the top 10 in wages in the Premier League all three of those seasons and have finished, you know, basically 16th or 17th every year. It's time.
If people want to continue to make the argument that the Premier League is the deepest top division in the world, they need to reconcile that with what we've seen from Sunderland, because Sunderland, for the last three or four years, have consistently played bad football except for one run each year. And yeah, of course, that's going to be enough for you to stay up. But for you to do it year after year after year, it says something about the Premier League that happens. Kartik, Villa, nil, Stoke, one. Second win in a row for Stoke. Reprieve for Mark Hughes. Looks like they might be on track. Tim Sherwood does not look like he has a formula that can keep Villa up.
No, if Brendan Rodgers wants a job again quickly, he could maybe have one of these two jobs very soon. Because, now Stoke is getting results, but they're not playing the Stoke alone away the way Sparky wants them to play. They were very fortunate against Bournemouth last week. This week they were the better team, but they were playing just a team that's really not at a Premier League level at all. When we talk about this league getting better in the middle and some of the players that have come in from the continent. So a very, very poor performance from Villa. Stoke will take the points. I don't know that Rodgers wants either one of these jobs. I don't know that he wants to rush back into management, but maybe Randy Lerner, in his attempts to sell the team, will realize bringing in a Rodgers as a long-term solution and maybe giving him a transfer kitty in January will help him flip the club sooner. Who knows? But otherwise,
why would
I think Villa.
Why would Rodgers want that?
That's what I'm thinking. Maybe Rodgers doesn't want a job like this. But Villa are in bad, bad shape. And it's not a reflection of Tim Sherwood. They just do not have the horses to stay up.
Yeah. And as harsh as you and I were on Sunderland a moment ago, Kartik, the story is the same with Villa. Every year, relegation battle. Think you're going in a new direction. No, it's just not happening. Lawrence, two teams that we've been very high on throughout this season, Norwich, Leicester City. Leicester gets a 2-1 win. Very good result on the road.
Yeah, another great result on the road. And I think that what Ranieri liked most was he was saying, I'm an old-style defender, so I like these kind of battles between our guys and theirs. And I mean, maybe that's what's going to shape this side up so well, is that he seems to be relishing this role within the Premier League. You know, we expected him to be up there with those top managers, and you know, he built Chelsea. But also, you know, the fact that then he went back to Italy and we kind of forgot about him for a little while. I think what he's doing with the English players, but also the likes of Schlupp, who he pushed up from left back, and then I know Okazaki didn't have a great game, but you know, the fact that he is bringing in players like that. It just makes this team so exciting for Leicester, and it gives their fans a really great identity to carry around the league, which before was actually quite a negative one. So I think they thrive off that. For Norwich, I don't think it's so terrible. You know, they played fantastically, I think. And, you know, they could have been better at the back, but I still think there's enough there for them.
Quick stat. Yesterday when I checked the leading scorers in the Premier League at this time, four of the top five leading scorers have played in the Championship one of the last two seasons, the exception being Kun Aguero. Hmm. So, and that includes two guys on Leicester, Vardy and Mahrez. So really amazing how guys are coming up from the lower divisions, and with proper coaching, they're excelling. Callum Wilson being another guy, and of course he's out for 6 months, so he'll drop off that list. But it speaks well to the depth of strength of English football. Hmm.
One other result this week in Bournemouth, Watford, two teams that were in the Championship last year, 1-1 draw there. Watford, with only 7 goals allowed this year, one of 5 teams that share the best defensive record in the league. It's international break coming up, so we're probably not going to have a show this coming Sunday. We'll probably do the same thing we did last international break. Wait for the results to come in, have a midweek show, and preview the next weekend's worth of action in the Premier League. But until then, for Lawrence McKenna, I'm Richard Farley. Kartik?
Enjoy your football.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is produced by Christopher Harris and Richard Farley and is a production of worldsoccertalk.com. For more information on the show, check us out at worldsoccertalk.com or subscribe through our iTunes feed. You can follow World Soccer Talk on Twitter at World Soccer Talk or follow the show's hosts. Lawrence McKenna is at Lawscast, Kartik Krishnar is at KKFLA737, and I'm at Richard Farley.